Yeah. But so David canceled again.
David didn't make it?
He does not make it again. He's not going to make it.
Wow.
So
okay.
We'll just do
Wait, I got a note from him. And he really, he wants us, you know, he wants us to do those essays on the first principles and first values, one on each one.
Right.
But he pointed out that there's this implicit value that lives, that actually it's mentioned in the uniqueness interior science equation in the first principles and first values book, but it's not It's not differentiated as its own first principle and first value, and that's a tension. So he actually, it's a little bit of a pain in the ass, but he actually asked us to you know, just get him some material because he wants to actually write an essay on attention.
On attention, it's necessary. And you're saying it's woven into all of the other first principles and first values, or at least an important subset.
Yeah, it is. It is. So, I mean, maybe we can.
So he was like, maybe attention is a first principle and first value. Discuss.
Yeah, totally. And by the way, I can't quite hear you. The microphone might be able to, but I can't.
You can't hear me. Okay.
Just sharing that information. I mean, I can read your lips. We can try that. You know what I mean?
How about now?
Now I got you.
Gotcha.
I got you. Yeah. Awesome. I was having fun doing the lip reading thing. But so let me try and do a couple of riffs, and then you do a couple of riffs. We'll at least get something in here.
Great.
Okay. So. And maybe I'll split it into two sections, and you can tell me, can I lean back like this?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Okay. So let's just see if we can split it into two. And one will be let's look at where attention actually shows up in the first principles and first values.
Right.
You know, as they exist now in the first principles and first values book, kind of number one. And then two, let's look at attention kind of pre-modern, modern, postmodern, and see what's the post-postmodern or, you know, vision of attention and why that matters so much, right? And, you know, in a certain sense, you could say, why the fuck are we talking about attention? We're in the middle of a meta crisis. No, actually, it's the collapse of attention, which in some sense is one of the primary causes for the meta crisis.
Right.
So that's our frame. So I'm going to... So maybe tell me if this works for you, and we, you know, go back and forth. But I'll do like a first riff on the equations, flip it over to you. Then we'll do a second riff on the pre-modern, modern, post-modern, flip it to you.
But if I will, just a gloss on what you just said,
please.
Which is we've characterized the meta crisis as a global intimacy disorder. Right. And you're saying root to any intimacy disorder is actually some type of dysregulation of attention.
Yes, that is. I mean, that is exactly right. So that's actually the perfect way in. So one, well, let's start from there. We'll look at three equations. Okay, so let's actually start. I'm going to start with the Eros equation, right? And just, you know, if y'all haven't been hanging with us, first off, it's only our second one of these little conversations, so hanging would just be one podcast. But if you haven't been hanging in the cosmorotic humanism conversation for the last few years, so just to know that there's a book called First Principles and First Values where these equations are listed. So the Eros equation, and by Eros we mean not love as in ordinary love, right? But love as in the cosmic principle, right? Not love as ordinary human sentiment, but as the heart of existence itself. And we would call that Eros, or we would call it evolutionary love, or we'd call it outrageous love, but all terms for the same. So our equation is, and I'm going to do the equation not precisely, but I'm going to do it just kind of approximately. You know, Eros equals, right, the experience of radical aliveness, desiring, big word desiring, ever deeper contact and ever greater wholes or ever greater wholeness. So in that equation, right, is Eros and ethos, number one, right, and attention. Right, because ethics is about the nature of our contact with each other. Right? We want deeper contact, so deeper contact requires greater ethics, greater, and deeper contact means at its core deeper attention. Right, so the desire for deeper contact, that desire, which is a desire of cosmos, which lives all the way down and all the way up. right? Now, desire is the nature of reality, and we give it different names. But for example, we call it allurement, the allurement that animates the four forces. And we kind of understand that allurement, which is another word, again, for eros, right? Eros, right, whose expression is desire, right? Eros or love, right, is the precise right nature of the contact, right? So it's not why you fused all the way. Well, that's not right contact. It's not that you were totally autonomous. That would be dissociation. Fusion and dissociation wouldn't be love. Love would actually be all the way down, right? Protons, electrons, and neutrons, and, you know, Mark and Zach, or, you know, Ken and, you know, Treya at their best. We were just thinking about Ken today, right? You know, would be the exact right calibration, right, of contact, which is exactly the right level of attention, right? And then that then creates larger wholeness and larger wholes, right? I mean, parts creating a greater whole, right, is essentially parts placing attention on each other. And in that placing of attention, something's actually created. And so we'll get maybe next week until kind of like how attention shows up as a first principle and first value. And what does that mean, that attention is creative, that it blooms reality, right? But you already see it here, right? Is that eros, which is the creative movement, right, is animated by attention. And attention is creative. Attention blooms reality. Attention is generative by its nature, right? So that's one. And I'm going to resist the temptation to kind of go down the road of attention being generative and start to talk about differentiation and attachment theory. Well, that's a separate conversation. So two is the intimacy equation. I just want to stay close to our equations. We'll just do two more, and then two, brother. Thank you for giving me the time to lay it out. So intimacy is in the intimacy equation and the eros equation, these two interior science equations that are foundational to cosmogonic humanism, we know are kind of mirrors of each other. So intimacy equals shared identity, but it can't just be shared identity because you have to place attention on each other. So it's got to be shared identity in the context of otherness. Again, the precise balance of autonomy and communion, right? So intimacy equals shared identity in the context of otherness, meaning we're placing just the right amount of attention on each other to be both part of a larger whole and to be distinct. So intimacy equals shared identity in the context of relative otherness. And then it goes times mutuality of recognition, which is pure attention, times mutuality of pathos, we feel each other, which is attention, right? Times mutuality of value, meaning we're in a shared field of value, which actually is the prism through which our attention moves, times mutuality of purpose, which means we have a shared attention on a future, right? We have a shared desire. We have a purpose. We have a telos. We have a shared telos. Telos, which is another dimension of shared attention, right? And so you can't even think about the intimacy equation without it being lined with this notion of attention. And then finally, three, just to get this on the table, right? Three is the uniqueness equation itself, right? And the uniqueness equation, right? You know, I'm flipping open the book here, but the uniqueness equation is basically at its core is that uniqueness is the differentiation of the field, right? In other words, there's a field of eros, there's a field of, you know, of desire, right, of intimacy, right? And uniqueness is, you know, the differentiation of that field. So uniqueness is the emergent distinction from the field, right? That's the emergent distinction from the field of, right, which generates new value, right? New capacity, right? And what we say in this equation is, I'll actually read it just for a second, right? Let me just actually read it. It's fun to read it. Okay, right? It's the first time we've ever read from this book, right? This is fun. So uniqueness equals emergent distinction from the field of reality, universal reality, times radically new value, right? Because that emergent distinction is radically new value. And that radically new value is a new quality. It's new consciousness. Right?
You're not reading.
Right? Times, good point, times new capacity. And new capacity is, right, in parentheses, attention plus eros plus function, right, plus integration. So just to say that simply, right, for those of you not following that equation, right, uniqueness means two things. One is uniqueness comes from the differentiation of attention. I differentiate. I say, oh, I see that. So the seeing, right? The placing of attention generates the uniqueness, and then the uniqueness itself is a new quality of that which is attended to, but it also has a new capacity for placing attention. That's what uniqueness is. So Zach's attention, to say it simply, reality being Zach, is a particular quality of attention, right? That is completely different than reality being Mark. So if I called up your dad and said, "Hi, I'm Zach," he'd be quite disappointed, right? Because it's a different attention field, right? So yay. So that just kind of sets in play what's already in play to you, sir.
I mean, I'll say something which may or may not be true, but we have the first and the second order, first order and first principles.
Right. We do.
It may be that attention is a first order, first principle and first value.
That's interesting.
That's not listed, because the way you're describing it here is that you can't get most of the equations off the ground
without attention.
Without attention. You also can't get them off the ground without the other first order, first principles. That's one of the reasons they're first order. So temporality.
Time.
You don't have the dynamic equations unfolding over anything but time, right? So you need that. And I think we're saying here, the hidden and the revealed is another one, which again, the equations express what is hidden and it becomes mm-hmm. revealed. So some gloss perhaps on one of the first order principles and turn it more towards attention, or that attention itself needs to be considered.
You know what it could be? That's really interesting. It could be. So just for 10 seconds, I'm cheating because I have the book in front of me, just to say, right? So
it's not cheating.
We like books. So the first principles and first values, the first order principles, are the three perspectives, first, second, and third person, right? Time and eternity, the hidden and the revealed, right? Polarity and paradox, interiors and exteriors, value, and I intentionally changed the order. I'm reading this last one, right? I'm reading this one last, although it wasn't last, because this could be where attention comes in, wholes and parts.
Interesting.
Right, because wholes and parts, right, reality is composed of holons. There's no part that's not itself a whole, and no whole that's not itself a part. And as such, holarchies emerge. So that's just interesting, because when parts come together to create wholes, they're placing attention on each other. You know, but the truth is actually first, second, and third person are also quality. Right, I think it's all the way through, you're right.
Irrespective of where it fits, it's deep in the cosmic architecture.
Yeah.
That attention, as we unfolded last time, that it unfolds over all of the chains of the great chain of being.
Yeah. It could be a first order, right?
I think it may be.
It may be a first order. That's interesting, brother.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And it's deep, right?
It's deep.
And to give you a sense of kind of some of the sociology, one of the things that occurred to me.
We should send it to Dave and see what he thinks.
We should propose it as a first order.
You think we should? Yeah,
I think
okay,
so.
Okay, I think so. Okay.
I think so. We'll see what David says.
All right.
Yeah. So this notion that attention is a need of the cosmos would also imply that it's a human need, both to be able to have discretion over what you give your attention to and to be the receiver of the appropriate kinds of attention. And one of the things that's been up lately, just because of what's going on in society and the recent Senate hearing on protecting kids from social media, is this question of the correlation between social media use and adolescent mental health. And I had for the first time the thought that, yes, it is the case that the kids are attending to the phone, mm-hmm. and so therefore their attention is disrupted by the phone. But it's also the case that everybody else is looking at their phone, which means no one's paying attention to the kid.
Right.
So the root of the mental health crisis may not just be the fact that the kid's getting dysregulated by the phone. It may actually be more fundamentally the fact that he is not on the receiving end of any basic attention, the kind of attention that you could take for granted as a human before, which is just that you wake up in the morning, you sit down and your mom's there and she pays attention to you over breakfast, right? That may or may not happen now in a much more profound way. And it may not even appear to be neglect, because it is just normal.
Right.
So it's not even sociologically seen as bad that adolescents actually don't pay attention to each other anymore.
Right.
And what's even weirder is that if you are an influencer, someone who gets paid attention to a lot online, you're actually paid attention to asynchronously, meaning like we are recording this right now.
Right.
But it's just you paying attention to me. No one else is actually paying attention to us, technically speaking.
Right.
They will pay attention to a representation of us asynchronously at another time. So if you're an adolescent and you record a video of yourself for TikTok and it gets 1,000 views or whatever.
You don't have an embodied experience
and yet
of a neurochemical transformation and an interior transformation.
Right. And yet you've been massively paid attention to, more than any adolescent could have been, like thousands of people watching this thing.
Right.
So there's this very strange kind of almost paradox here
where
we're paying more attention, like kids are able to pay more attention to each other than ever, and yet they are not, in a very simple way,
that's great,
holding basic attention with each other.
They're not having an actual direct experience of being bloomed by attention directly.
Precisely.
It's actually That's right.
And so that I think, so the notion of how do you understand the mental health crisis, it is actually, I think, more fundamentally, that second absence of the right kinds of attention paid.
What is the name of beautiful, beautiful boy, such a beautiful boy that Christina introduced me to on a plane on the way to one of our mystery schools, who committed suicide, who did that beautiful song, Hey Brother, right? Hey Brother, I apologize, everyone. He was one of those DJs who kind of synchronizes, synthesizes, and kind of creates kind of new music. Avicii, right? I think. And he was just stunningly beautiful. And KK ran me through just both his music and these unimaginable crowds of people. Mm-hmm. Right? There's unimaginable attention on him.
Right.
And he commits suicide.
Right.
Right? It's at the point that you're making. Right, in a different way, right? Although that's not asynchronous, but it's not dissimilar from it in that when someone is placing attention on you directly, the two of you are talking, right? And love, of course, is the placing of attention, right? Then your life is self-evidently good, right? It's self-evident, you are in life, you're not exiting life. And paradoxically, that level of attention, right, is both enlivening in the moment and yet deadening in some fundamental way, because it's fundamentally not personal.
Right.
Attention is the discretion of infinity through a person to a person, mm-hmm. right? And that infinity is moving through me uniquely and then intimately and uniquely placing attention on you. Mm-hmm. So attention by its nature has a dimension of uniqueness,
yep.
which is why attention shows up in the uniqueness equation.
Yeah. And discretion.
And discretion.
A whole bunch of subtle characteristics that make the difference between the types of attention that are beneficial to people and the types of attention that actually are alienating and uncomfortable, right? So last time, I think we talked about surveillance.
Right.
As an example of a kind of attention you don't want. And yet the notion that God is aware of every hair in your head and that, like, the mothering one who wouldn't be smothering but would somehow know so much about exactly what you need is also reassuring. So there's this sense of, like, both wanting to be seen in some context and in another context not wanting attention. And so that notion of the intimacy disorder at a planetary scale being fundamentally rooted in an attentional deficit disorder.
In an imbalance of attention in a certain sense that moves in two directions. One is excessive attention,
right?
Which is why, you know, the European Parliament, you know, whatever, it's not exactly European Parliament, but the European structures are trying to create this right to be forgotten,
right?
You know, and right, the fundamental breakdown of attention, which, you know, is exacerbated by all the structures of modernity, has been talked about excessively, not excessively, but appropriately by, you know, any number of thinkers. So is this a good place to jump in? You want to get another point there?
One more thing.
Please.
Which is because you brought up, like, the celebrity status, and I brought up the kind of YouTube or TikTok.
Asynchronous attention.
Asynchronous attention. And then also the many watching the few as the model of the celebrity attention dynamic. And the many who watch the few goes way back in human history. When you think about the king.
Right.
And the aristocracy, they actually put themselves on display on purpose. So there's the many who watch the few is one model. And there's another model where the few watch the many.
Right.
And this is the panopticon, or the surveillance.
The surveillance model.
And then with the internet, you get, so the the many who watch the few is the classic broadcast celebrity.
Right.
And the few who watch the many is the classic surveillance panopticon. But the many watching the many is the postmodern digital thing, where the 15 minutes of fame for every person is possible.
Right. A kind of a complete, but it's a chaotic.
It's a chaotic.
Many watching the many without a kind of, without the underlying structure of order under chaos that chaos theory is trying to point to. It's,
correct.
It's chaos theory without the chaotic
orchestration. And it's also a kind of surveillance where it's like everybody's up in everyone's business in a completely different way. And a kind of narcissism that makes everyone believe they're a celebrity or somehow asymmetrically talented to deserve the 15 minutes. So it's a complex perspectival and attentional situation. And then when you add on the asynchronous dimension, it's very hard.
For asynchronous people, placing of attention.
Exactly. Then it's really hard to locate yourself. And it's only through attention that you literally locate yourself.
Right. Right. So the inability to locate the self.
Exactly.
So, that's great. So let's just think for a second. Let's see if we can kind of step back and kind of in kind of like the second part that we chat a little bit here, we just point a little bit to the nature of attention, but with the following intention, if you will, right? Which is what we really want to do, and maybe we'll talk about that next week, is we really want to trace the history of attention. And we want to kind of look at pre-modern attention, you know, in a word, the attention on God, right? You know, the attention on, you know, and the pre-modern monks, you place attention in order to create union with God. They knew exactly what attention was for in that model. You know, the movement of attention in modernity, and we'll talk much more about it, you know, next week, but the movement of attention from kind of God to man, kind of science, psychology, and yet also the emergence of new oppressive forms of attention, you know, kind of Taylorism factories, you know, that we've kind of, so that's kind of the kind of modern notion of attention we can get to next week. And then postmodern attention, which is there's actually nothing to pay attention to, right? In other words, and it's
because everything's equally worth paying attention.
Because everything's equally worth paying attention or worthless, right? Right. In other words, you know,
ignoring.
That's right. Kind of Spinoza's comment that, you know, the most, you know, polite form of atheism is pantheism,
right?
You know, in other words, which was not completely accurate, but not entirely inaccurate, meaning there actually is no hierarchy because there is no quality. So nothing's better than anything else and nothing's worse than anything else. And so there's nothing to pay attention to.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's great. If I would say reconstructing that.
So that the we had meetings with that.
History. Yeah.
And I think David, I got, it's weird. He was like on a new app. So I think he kind of said he wants us to talk about that. And I think he wants to even write about that this week.
I'd be happy to do that. The best way to do that would be to talk about McLuhan though. Like you can't really do that reconstruction of the history of attention without looking at the history of media specifically. Before the pre-modern is the pre-pre-modern.
Right.
Which McLuhan gets into, right? Because you start with oral.
Right,
you don't start with text, and you don't start with monks and God and agrarian societies. You start with the oral cultures, then you get the text-based cultures.
Which is this very dramatic history of attention.
Dramatic history of attention tied into the history of technologies, communication technologies.
Right, so the whole thing, right? Exactly. So the history of attention and the history of communication technologies are deeply interwoven with each other. So what I'm going to suggest is let's do like this. We've got about 10 minutes.
Yeah, and what's crazy is the pre-human.
Let's actually each do a take on this because we could do like this because what I was going to do is, just thinking about this, brother, I was going to kind of go into kind of, you know, the kind of the nature of attention itself. But I'm going to kind of send a bracket that and just maybe put one thing on the table that we can get to next week, which is there's this whole realization that the collapse of attention, right, is the cause of all forms of evil, which is not wrong. And placing attention on that is critical. Right? We need to value attention. But as we've talked about so many times together in the last years, you can't value attention unless attention is a first principle and first value. So what we're moving towards is to actually locate in this post-postmodern moment, in this new moment, in this new story of value, attention as a first principle and first value. So I'm saying let's bracket that conversation. I'm going to bracket that. And maybe if we can each do like 5 minutes on pre-modern, modern, and postmodern, maybe you hit the McLuhan stuff a little bit. I'll kind of do a little bit of a deeper take, pre-modern, modern, postmodern. At least we'll have that on the table because I think he wants to start writing. So at least we'll do that for him. Is that fair?
Sure.
Okay. So let me just kind of recapitulate in my mind. So pre-modern, and so we're not going back to the oral for a second. I'm going, let's kind of go into kind of classical pre-modern last couple thousand years. We're already in the written word. So in the pre-modern world, you're paying attention. You know, I grew up in a pre-modern tradition, which I still actively practice, right? You know, within a larger context. And I would, you know, do a particular prayer, which has, you know, about 30 words, which one does not fulfill one's kind of sacred obligation, if you will, for that prayer without actually having attention on every word of the prayer, right? Meaning on the you, right? I'm in prayer to the you and on the meaning of the prayer. And that's the first blessing in the 18 benedictions that are kind of this daily prayer. So in most of the prayer, there's kind of a general intention on you're before the you, right? Before the second person. But in these, the first blessing, which is again about 30 words, there's actually a kind of ritual legal requirement to have attention on every word, right? And to know the meaning of every word. So I would, a couple hours in the morning, keep trying to do it again, right? In other words, the practice was for many years, right? To keep placing attention on every word,
right?
And that really captures the best of pre-modernity, right? Which is your attention is on the field of the divine. It's acosmic, right? It's all God, right? And therefore you place attention. You're always placing attention on the divine. You're always placing attention on God. Every place you're placing attention is to reveal the God in it and to reveal, you know, to reveal the inherent divinity that's always there. But that's where the attention goes, right? It's towards that revelation and towards the union with that, towards participation in that. So that's one, right? The modern, you know, as we already noted, right, has this shift towards three things. I'll just say them and it won't even indulge in them. One is romantic love. So it's attention on each other romantically, right? In other words, not love of God, it's love of each other, right? Whether that's romantic, right? Man, woman in the classical sense, or it's, you know, Alexander Dumas, right? The Three Musketeers, all for one and one for all, but it's not really all for France or all for the church. Those are kind of mocked. It's really fraternity. It's placing attention on each other again, right? And it's placing attention on, you know, this world. So kind of David's Michelangelo, right? He's not obeisant to the divine. He's this emergent, you know, shining, you know, figure who clearly has dignity and who has eros, right? It's attention on humanity. It's attention on interior psychology. It's attention on science in terms of its inherent laws of nature and not to reveal the divine in it, right? So that's modernity. And it just kind of assumes the value of things without actually establishing it, which we've talked about at great length, the kind of that assumption. Then finally, post-modernity, that all breaks down and there's this realization, wow, right? There is no real story of value, right? That value actually is not real. That implication of modernity breaks out in post-modernity. And so therefore, there's no place that ultimately deserves our attention, right? That's the postmodern mind. And then the internet becomes the exteriorization of the postmodern mind. Our attention is pulled in 1,000 different directions. And there's nothing wrong with stealing attention because there's nothing to place attention on. And attention is not a value. So what's the problem? Boom. So we're trying to get to the fourth, which we get to next week, which is, okay, what's our reclaiming of attention? So put that aside. And I would love to, like in the 5 minutes we have left, hear some McLuhan.
Yeah, I mean, and McLuhan is really about the history of the transformations of attention,
looking at it that way, completely.
It's what it is, and even just the idea that the media of communication are extensions of the senses,
right,
and powers of the human, and so a little bit before you get the kind of like pre-modern, you get biosemiotics, right? You get the communication technologies of the biological world, chemical and vision and all of this stuff.
And before biosemiotics, you've got the interior communication between protons, neutrons, electrons, et cetera.
Exactly. So we won't get into kind of like pan-semiotic evolutionary theory, but that's
right. But that's pan-semiotic evolutionary theory is key here.
And then that blends into looking at the history of attention through this transformation of basically communication technologies, starting with language and innovations in language.
From oral to language.
Oral being language.
Right.
And like before language, which specifically would be propositionally differentiated speech, we paid attention to each other's vocalizations in a different way. So animals pay attention to each other's vocalizations.
That's what I meant by oral to language.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oral is grunt.
Grunt. And then, but the beginning of it really is what we would think of as language. When humans first get propositionally differentiated speech and they start sitting around the fire and they start telling complex stories to each other.
Right.
Story, language.
So oral to language to story is the semiotic thread.
Language allowing story, and specifically the oral cultures being continuous with the biosemiotic attention to nature that the early humans must have had to spend. So they were communicating with nature and attending to nature in a way that we probably can't even really understand.
Right.
So there was before the attention to God, as it were, in the pre-modern with the great traditions,
right?
You had what they would say is paganism, which is paying attention to the forces of nature.
kind of the Garden of Eden before God speaks.
Correct.
Exactly. I mean, right. That's beautiful, right? The Garden of Eden before God speaks.
These are the oral cultures. And then there's a huge transformation in the history of attention with the emergence of the written word. So you don't get anything that resembles what we think of as civilization, which Mumford characterized as the mega machine. You don't get any of that without the ability to have a written word. Because you need to keep records, you need to have written laws, you need to give exact instructions to people who are thousands of miles away with a runner, and all of these things that characterize the early civilizations. And the focus on the written word gives us a whole bunch of crazy things occurring, including things that we think of as schools, scholarly and priestly castes, libraries, and specifically history in a written form.
Which is a new form of placing attention on the story.
Correct. And so now we can, at great distance from one another, very precisely attend to exactly the same thing.
Right.
And we can now integrate.
It creates a shared attention space in humanity.
Exactly. So then you get the printed word. So it starts with papyrus and, you know, clay tablets and stuff. But then when you get the printing press, the so-called Gutenberg revolution, that is again a radical transformation, because now you don't have a small number of people dealing with a written word and allowing for this kind of like early pre-modern organization. You get the kind of high pre-modern organization, which is where you get the Protestant revolution and this massive move towards the democratization of access to text, and that births modernity.
And modernity is, in a word, this is a beautiful way to say modernity, is, now the ordinary human's attention on politics and economics is possible and wanted and desired.
Yeah, and specifically—
There's no reason for a pre-modern ordinary human to place their attention on that. It had nothing to do with them.
Yeah, totally. And the idea that the text mediates the relationship between you and God individually, which is part of the Protestant Revolution, which is, comes from the fact that you could translate the Bible into the native languages and print them.
So it's actually the sacralization of the attention of the individual human who's not part of the elite. Yeah. That attention is the nature of modernity.
Totally. And the idea of like a human sitting alone with a book is weird, like from like the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years before the printing press. Humans didn't, they sat and they talked to each other, you know what I mean? But the idea that now you're going to be alone with a text and be communicating with an author who died 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago. So the possibilities for identity formation and what you have the discretion to pay your attention to expands drastically. You're an aristocrat in the Middle Ages with a library. And that's like some radical, crazy identity formation material that just wasn't available to attend to before that. So, and we got to wrap now, but then you get the electric, which gives us radio and television. And that, again, as you can see with the effect of television, fundamentally transforms the dynamic away from text back to the oral in a certain way.
Like right.
The radio revives the fireside chat, as Roosevelt described his communications to the country for the first time. Through the radio, you sit and huddle around the radio as if it's a campfire and you listen. You don't read,
right.
You listen. So you move through the electric to the digital, and then you return to the text, in a sense, but also have available all the other prior modalities. So the digital recapitulates a return, in a sense, to a type of pre-modern. So we can talk about that next time.
Let's pick up exactly here, yeah, right? Let's totally. Pick up exactly here. There's so yeah. much to say, but we'll, yeah, right we'll pick up exactly here.
Yeah.
Yay.